It's an honor every time I say to come here. I was a pastor in town for 16, 17 years, so some of you I know from those years. Hospice of Santa Barbara director for 5.5. Some of you I know from those years. Been at La Casa now a year and a half. So I know some of you from this time. So it's kind of fun. Each time I come back, there's like another part of my life that I get to connect with. Things at La Casa are going well. We're excited. We just submitted in the summer a big $800,000 water stewardship grant to the state of California. That they really are interested in working with us to do some cutting edge water stewardship in the next decade or two. And program wise, we've got, I think a lot of you get our program guide, and we have a new newsletter be coming out in a couple of weeks. As an example, one of the things we're doing, last April we started doing a John Muir Spirituality and the Environment event. We wanted to do that every April. John Muir's birthday was in April and Earth Day is in April. So this year we're having a Friday where we have Joni Chancer, who's a very much loved art teacher, doing a whole outdoor painting thing. On Saturday we're doing a thing we're calling Birds, Bees, and Trees. And we'll have a bird expert, a insect and bee expert, and a tree expert. Birds, bees, and trees. Anyway, so they'll give a talk about the natural environment at La Casa, and then we'll go out and have time to reflect and see that dimension and come back and hear more about the next presentation. So by the end of the day, each of us will have three different experiences of La Casa, the trees, the bees, and the birds, as just a way to deepen our awareness. And then on Sunday, we're cooperating with the Montecito Jewish community, the Montecito Shul, and we're going to have a hike up San Isidro Trail with a rabbi who has a website called, I think it's called Torah on the Trail, and his whole ministry in the Jewish in his Jewish service is reconnecting people with nature in terms of Judaism. Rabbi Cohen, who some of you know at B'nai B'rith, is an active hiker and has pointed out to me recently that all the great events happen outdoors. So anyway, that's the kind of thing we're doing. We're trying to mix different dimensions of life and what we're all yearning for. So I was grateful to have a chance to take this book and read my portion of it and do what I can to help with everybody today to kind of think about it. So what my plan is that this is the overview. And then I'll kind of go through the first couple of chapters and a little bit of the prelude, the preface rather, and talk about what I think are some key things. And then a little point on a philosopher named Albert Borgman about friction and character that came to mind as I was reading this material. And then when I was reading this, I was restless, and I kept thinking, what is it about the book that was making me restless? And I came up with a simple way to talk about it. I'm going to call Sacred Thirds. I'm not a musician, I wish I was, but it's more about the way we think of spiritual life in a global historical context. We want to hopefully have time to, I'll tell you a story about some of my interfaith work and why I think it really has something to add to what Thomas More is saying. And then, in the end, just a little quick look at one person's view of the three stages of global spiritual development. So, here we go. And I understand 10 o'clock is snack time. I got that. It was 11 o'clock, I'm sorry. So, when Moore starts in that introduction, he says that, talks about soul, that soul is the unreachable depth, the vitality, and the full presence of a person or even a thing. Sometimes buildings seem to have soul. It seems to me most buildings built before 1940 have soul, and a lot of them built since the 60s, a lot of them don't. And I don't know why that is, but there's something about that. Religion implies some kind of action, often one that is symbolic or ethical. One reason I prefer the word religion over spirituality. And that's kind of surprising to me. Most people want spirituality these days more than religion. And I was also wondering about his definition, because the Latin, and hopefully there's a Latin scholar that can help us, but religion is religio. It's like a ligament that you're reattaching. So to me, it's always meant connection. Moore has a different take on it. And he says, my hope is that you will create a religion of your own. And I think if his history, of course, is entering with a lot of sense of calling into a monastic Catholic life, and then becoming kind of disillusioned with it, and realizing that it's disconnected from a lot of the way where people live in their life, and so he really wants people to be able to find something that's very genuine and authentic for each person. And he talks about the idea for this book began with a visit to Walden Pond, and which I think he lives near there in Massachusetts. And for reasons I'll talk about later, it was interesting to me that he brought his homeschooled daughter with him to Walden. But Henry David Thoreau going to Walden, leaving behind a lot of traditional religion, really becoming more in the immediate moment, really connecting with his senses, connecting with his own soul rather than what somebody tells him his soul is supposed to be, and then developing a philosophy of life from that. I think for Moore, that's a real central inspiration for him. And he says, I'm not talking about a selfish, ego-centered, loosely patched together spiritual concoction. I'm recommending a courageous, deep-seated, fate-driven, informed, and intelligent life that has sublime and transcendent dimensions. It can be shared in community. And then he says, it's all about really building your own cathedral. Whether Thoreau built his cabin in Massachusetts or Carl Jung built his stone house by the lake where he was, that each of us, whether we build something physically or not, but we in our lives, he thinks we'll gain a great deal if we think of how do we build a place of worship and focus in our own life that's very real for us. Okay, so places that have soul. He talks about places that have soul, and I thought, okay, for me, what places have soul in Santa Barbara? It doesn't have to be Santa Barbara. And tell me if you recognize this place. That's Harry's, right? And that is a soulful place. And I think, well, why would that come to mind so quickly? I think it's because Harry's is one of a kind. It has history. It has, I mean, it's the one waitress, her name? Renee, she's been there 50 years. There's a guy who works in the kitchen that's been there 60 or something. There's people that have been going there for decades. They're not really worried about cholesterol. And you have these warm leather booths to sit in, and there's families coming in, and all this kind of stuff. And, I usually don't eat the main courses there. But to go to Harry's, there's something about it that I think, to me, it's got soul. Another place, just down the street from here, is Garrett's. Garrett's down here on Mission and State. That came to mind. I thought, well, why is that? Well, it's not a chain. It's not the people that work there don't have a corporate established uniform on. They're not really worried about Santa Barbara cuisine, It's like biscuits and gravy and good stuff. And again, the people that work there seem to be really connected. They have regular customers. It's kind of, in my mind, it came to mind. And another place that came to mind is the Santa Cruz Market. And I'm thinking of the one, I don't know how many of you ever go in the Santa Cruz Market out in Goleta, but having lived in Goleta 20-some years, I'll go in there sometimes for something. The odor reminds me of Mexico, just all the things that are there for sale. People know each other, people of different ages. I don't know, something about the concrete floors and the way it's a local business. And it just seems like it has there's something alive there. And sometimes I'll go into, I'll just say like a Vons or something, with all the lights and flashing coupons. Sometimes the people that work there often are kind of friendly, but they also seem kind of disconnected from their work. So to me, if I think of soul in Santa Barbara, I think of Harry's, Garrett's, and Santa Cruz Market. But just for anybody, what places have soul for you in Santa Barbara or Goleta or Carpinteria? Any place come to mind that a place when you go there it just has a presence? Yeah.
Petrini's.
Same kind of feeling? Yeah.
The Natural History Museum.
The beach. The beach has soul. Yeah, Don. Of which canyon?
Stowe Canyon.
Oh, Stowe Canyon. Right. The old house and the yeah.
The Botanic Garden.
Botanic Garden. It's got a sense of reverence for life. Yeah, John.
La Casa de Maria.
Oh. That's great. It's funny. I didn't think of that. I guess because I but it does have soul. And boy, do I, now that I'm working there all the time, it's just something. People say, I came here and I don't know why. It just feels different. What is it about this place? Thank you, John. La Casa de Maria. I think the mission kind of has soul. You have the sense of history and things are you have presence. Yeah, in the back?
Santa Barbara Cemetery.
Santa Barbara Cemetery. The one down there, Montecito?
Yeah.
That has a sense of depth about it. Yeah.
Isla's Keck Park.
And Shoreline. Vedanta Temple, absolutely. Yeah, that sense of quiet reverence that and devotion that goes on there. Yeah.
Brophy's.
I was going to put Brophy's. Somebody was telling me, actually, a bartender at Harry's was telling me that at one time Brophy's had the highest customers per square foot in America. In terms of, literally, that it had, and you never can get in there, right? It's pretty rare, and it's tourists and it's locals. There's something about Brophy's that really is like a magnet and people feel different when they're there. Okay, one more. Yeah.
The Home Improvement Center.
The one on Gutierrez? Yeah, that's true, isn't it? And nothing against Home Depot, right? Or Osh, but the Home Improvement Center, it feels more homegrown, doesn't it? It feels kind of grassroots. So, yeah, Yoli. Yes, La Casa de Maria, absolutely. Yoli, you agree with John. That's a great place. So I think, I really resonate with what he says, that there's some places that really have soul. His next chapter is the spiritual traditions today. And he says there are many traditions, and you can draw on all of them. He says, what you need to do is look for the key idea. As you're looking at different traditions, look for the key idea. And I'll just say I have a little issue with that because it means we're already looking for something that resonates with us without really letting the tradition speak for itself. But anyway, so, his suggestion is, hey, look for the key idea in Islam or Buddhism or different places. And he said, if you want to see real religion, look at my liturgical calendar, his personal one, which is a combination of civic, world religion, and personal holy days. So he's thought about calendars and seasons, but because he's been connected with different religions and studied them and benefited from them, in his personal calendar he includes a lot of those dates. He says that Emerson showed us the power of the individual soul. So in American religious history, he really values the way that Emerson was able to describe that in non-doctrinaire language. And he says, religions can be seen as convivial. To create a religion of one's own, start by never again sensing any conflict between one tradition and another. I kind of paused at that. I've been fascinated for 25, 30 years with other religions, and as John said, I've been involved in interfaith work here for a long time. And at the end of the day, I'll tell a story about how that's meant so much to me. But the deeper I've gotten, there are real differences. Just take Jesus. For Christians, Jesus is pretty central. For Muslims, he's a prophet. For Jews, he can be kind of a heretic insofar as he says he's God. So there's things we can look for common ground, but if you don't want to look or recognize differences when you see them, it's kind of you're kind of narrowing your view. That's just my two cents. But anyway. Then the next chapter, he talks about the natural mystics. And he says, mystics are the ones who have actually gotten in touch with what is real. So, you know, whether any time in the history of religious traditions, a mystic is somebody who finds that they're not just in their head or just part of some tradition that they're just happen to be allied with. They really connect with what's real and often what's mysterious and wonderful. He talks about Simone Weil, about your religion makes real demands on you. So her as she searched for things, of course, she really identified with the poor and the working class, almost starved herself to death to find that kind of bond. So she was really seeking for that on a Jewish-Catholic border. He says there are mystical possibilities in the ordinary. Mysticism involves a constructive loss of self and a feeling of being connected to the whole of life. So this is this classic thing, going back to Rudolf Otto and these others, that the great spiritual moments is often when I feel my ego suddenly recedes in the background and my soul's able to come forward, and I feel smaller than I may in day-to-day imagination, but I see the world is so much bigger, and I'm still here, but I'm in awe of what's beyond me, not just trying to see everything in terms of what I need or what I want it to be. He talks about experiences in nature, that when in his younger years he used to spend time by the Detroit River and just being there and sitting there really reconnect him in a way that he would call being a natural mystic. Talks about how Zen and Taoism have a lot of richness in helping articulate what that's like. And he talks about a friend of his who's a flower arranger, and how that really becomes kind of a sacrament for him of connecting in an everyday way. He talks about his uncle's farm that he grew up on at times when he was younger, and how his uncle was really connected to the land and the cycles of life. And he talks about the Shakers and the way that their deep spirituality led them to a reverence for how they made furniture as well as how they lived. James Hillman, he says that, quotes that the focus of contemplation can be ordinary life, the natural world, deep feelings, and important relationships. So we don't have to necessarily take a text that a religion has given us and make that our only contemplation. We can just look at our lives, ordinary lives, natural world, deep feelings we have, and the important relationships in our life. And that can be the material from which we create a religion, as he would say, of our own. He has a great reverence for Georgia O'Keeffe's art, who he says, like James Hillman, chose a church-free way of being religious. But also he says that he talks about Merton and Teilhard, that they created authenticity within a religion. So some people go outside of a religion, others do it from within. So as I read this material, I had some appreciation for it. He talks about art and music. A lot of his musical tastes certainly connect with mine. Made me think of this painting of Van Gogh that, as you may know, at this point, you know, Van Gogh grew up in a strict Calvinist Dutch Reformed household, contemplated going into the ministry at one point, but then turned and went out to use his passion for painting to express the hunger that he didn't feel was fed for him, that was satisfied in religion. So in a letter he wrote to his brother, he talks about when he painted this, that the blueness of the sky is meant to be connected with and contrast with the blueness of the church. And he made the blueness inside the church a little darker, because he says that it gets dark when the preaching is really bad. That if you go into a beautiful little village church, but you go in there and there's some boring, disconnected homily going on, you don't feel necessarily presence there. But if you see this peasant woman walking down this road with the natural environment and this gorgeous blue sky, he's basically saying you can find the divine outside of church, you know, for Van Gogh. And I've been to a lot of churches. I would agree with him. Others that I wouldn't. Others that I feel deep presence. But and then, you know, made me think of this famous potato eaters. Instead of doing, you know, women in salons and everybody all dressed up in Paris, he really wanted to just say ordinary people, the people you would never have modeled for a painting of yours, these peasant potato eaters at their table. There's a beauty in them. There's a soulfulness in them, an earthiness. So I think as I read more, I think about those kinds of things. And it, for me, it connects with my life journey of looking for wisdom, transcendence, and immanence. That's included rooting myself in... rooting in one tradition doesn't mean like, go, but rooting, putting down roots, which for me was in the Protestant denomination for almost 30 years. Appreciating all traditions and drawing on secular culture. Music moves me, baseball moves me. And with music, you know, I love sacred music, and I've talked here before, I think, about opera and those kinds of things. But I remember years ago when I was a pastor up in rural Washington State, I was asked to do a funeral for a woman who died in her 50s, who didn't have a no church connection, and somehow somebody knew me, and they thought, well, maybe he'll do it. So I got involved with the family. We created the service, and it was going to be at a fairly large mortuary in Yakima, Washington. And they said, you know, the one piece of music that we really want to play is Send in the Clowns, you know? And I was like, oh. Haven't had that before in a church service. But I thought, you know, if that was what was meaningful to her. So I'll never forget, in that service, as things went on, there were some remembrances, and then a recording came on of Send in the Clowns. There wasn't a dry eye in the house. There was something about that Broadway musical, the music, the feeling of it, and the kind of the melancholy in it, that everybody really connected with her memory and their own life. So I'm fascinated by the power of music of all kinds to really evoke that in us, deep sense of meaning. And for me, my life has certainly been an eclectic mix that is personal. I've kind of built my own sense of spirituality a lot, and longs for soul. I long to find new ways to feel soulful. No one place is enough for me. I mean, I like to be based somewhere, but I like to keep looking over the horizon a little bit and wanting to learn and be challenged to think of things in different ways. And for you, just real quick, anything that particularly resonated in those first couple chapters of Moore? Anything that I didn't mention? Yeah.
You sort of mentioned it, but the very cursory mention of community.
Oh, sure. She said the very cursory mention of community. Right? Yeah, I sense that. In fact, that's where one. I gotcha. I'm with you. Anybody else? I mean, I've. Yeah.
I felt that the first couple of chapters, he wanted you to go out and look for whatever. And do a lot of research.
Uh-huh.
That gave us lots of books and names, and I found that very nice.
So he gave you a lot of resources to go out and find for yourself.
Totally.
Here's like a menu of things. Yeah.
Because one night, I'm sitting in bed and I'm looking at my iPad and I think, I wonder what the Quran is about.
Uh-huh.
All this ISIS stuff. And
yeah, yeah.
So I type in Quran. And stuff starts coming up, and my husband says, what are you doing? And I said, I'm looking up the Quran. Get out of that site.
She was saying she looked up the Quran one night, and her husband said, get out of that site on your iPad. Yeah, right.
Whatever's are out there looking to see who's picking up stuff like that.
Right, some CIA scanners just picked up spying on you. I mean, that's, yeah. And, you know, for a couple thousand years, it wouldn't have been the case. But it is now. Yeah, Jackie.
I was interested, I don't see this very often, but he differentiates between the soul and the spirit.
Yeah, he does, doesn't he? And he kind of seems to have a preference for soul.
Don't forget to repeat.
Oh, I'm sorry. Jackie says he differentiates between soul and spirit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so often people think of them as one and the same.
Right.
And could you tell me what your definition of
soul? Oh, my.
Between the soul and the spirit.
Yeah. I should have a thoughtful answer ready for that. I don't know. I think of soul as kind of grounding and connecting with what's right here, with me in my life or at a place, where spirit is maybe something that comes in that I don't know where it's from, the unconscious or the world or something, and kind of comes from outside and works through me, whereas soul is kind of sinking in.
Okay. So was you yourself, your essence, perhaps, do you think?
Yeah, yeah, I think so. Certain kind of character.
And the spirit is?
Spirit is something that comes, passes through. I mean, the scriptural, you know, metaphors are often wind, of course, and that kind of a thing. But it's a fascinating, and a lot of people have different takes on that.
Soul needs spirit,
yeah. I've heard that soul may be rooted to the same root as soil. I don't know if that's true or not, soul and soil. So there's a sense of going down. But in, as you may know, in Hebrew, the word for spirit is ruach, which is the wind that blows. And in, for Jesus, it's pneuma, like pneumonia and pneumatic tire, this that which you can't see, which is moving. So, yeah, one more. Yeah.
I just wanted to add to that comment because I have been struggling with what does he mean? Why is he differentiating soul and spirit as I've been reading the first couple of chapters in this book? And the best way for me that I can actually wrap my brain around more elementally, like you're referring to, like, you know, spirit being more like air and soul being more like water. Earth, wind, fire, and air.
Uh-huh.
And the water runs deep and it permeates everything, whereas spirit is light and more ephemeral.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I think that's, you know, when I find myself thinking, baseball fan, so some years ago, the Los Angeles Dodgers for many years did their spring training in Vero Beach, Florida, and it was going to be their last year there. So friend and I said, we've got to make a pilgrimage. This is the last chance. So we went there, and that stadium in Vero Beach, Florida, is kind of creaky, kind of mildewy, very soulful. There were no big screens up there. A lot of New York accents from Brooklyn sitting in the stands. But when good things happened in the game, something kind of swept through and animated people. So it's almost like the stadium was soulful to me. But spirit kind of would come at times and be felt more at times than others. So... okay, let me keep, and I'm sorry because I know that usually when questions are asked, we use the microphone. Just wanted to touch with you. But I'm going to kind of move now, step back a little bit from more, and a different sense of finding wholeness. And I thought about it, and I thought, well, this is kind of Confessions of a Soul-Searching Extrovert. Because I really thought, you know, a lot of what the Moore seems to me very introvert, his gift is that how do you really go inward? And I think I'm an extrovert. So some of what you'll see me tracking with now, maybe it's just an extrovert's take on the same from the same starting point. But so that's where we're going to go. And we're going to look at some of these, what I call these sacred circles and sacred thirds, rather. And so I want to make this comment. Back in 2000, I had the privilege of having a sabbatical, and I did a lot of work on technology, digital technology, and how it was affecting spiritual life. I was privileged to be a visiting scholar at UCSB, and I had a grant, and I got to go to India and Silicon Valley and interview people and all that. And did a lot of reading and research, and I came across a philosopher at the University of Montana named Albert Borgman, and found his work really insightful. And just one little theme from him. He talked about the relationship of friction and character in a digital privatizing culture. So one way to think about it, if I'm 100 years ago, if I'm cold and I'm living, say, at Walden, and I want to get warm, what do I need to do? I need to get up. I need to have an axe that I need to know how to care for and keep sharp. I have to go out in the forest and know which kind of trees maybe are the right trees to cut down at this time. I need to know how to be able to fell a tree safely and properly, how to then chop it into logs, how to get some of that back to my cabin. When I'm there, I have to know, with no propane or anything, I have to know how to start a fire, maybe on a snowy or cold time, and how to tend the fire. Each step of the way, there's something kind of opposing my desire to... get warm, and I have to keep working through that and building skill to get what I feel like I need, which is warmth. A lot of stages. If I get up in the morning in my house and it's cold, I go to the thermostat and I go. So there's no effort involved. And we love technology in the sense that we think, thank God we don't have to do all that. We can just push a little button. We don't have to keep a sharp axe and know where to go and everything else. But Borgman's point is that the more technology makes things easy for us and releases us from having to work against things, it's kind of the character. We don't become as skillful, and we become a little lazier in terms of how to deal with things. And when you look at it in terms of the concerns people have about technology and kids, when I was working all this stuff, my poor family had to listen to me talk about all this stuff all the time. But one day my youngest daughter wanted to play a computer game, and it was Sunday. And in that time we were trying to have Sunday be a technology-free Sabbath, just to see what that would be like for one day, you know. So she really wanted to play this computer game. I can't remember what it was. And I was like, no, you can't do it. You know, whatsoever. It's the Sabbath. Good Calvinist, you know. And so she was kind of grumpy. And then she wouldn't. And I said, well, why don't you call your friend Caitlin up the street? You guys could maybe do something together. And she goes, well, we just had a fight. And I said, well, you could call her and just see if she wants to play. So after a while, she was so bored, she called her friend Caitlin. They were kind of surly. But they got it together. And an hour later, they were out playing with Barbies or something. And I always think of that, because if I sit at a computer, I get to pick among thousands, tens of thousands of games, the one I want. I get to set the skill level that I want, and if I'm ever bored, I just exit and go to another game. If I'm with a human being with whom I've had a disagreement, none of that really works. I have to work through that. I have to put out some effort, and it's not often a trial, it's a labor. But in the process, I learn about myself and other people, and it builds character. You see the difference? So that as technology removes friction from our lives, the question is, are we losing an opportunity to build character? Borgman's pretty interesting, and that was just one of the things. But as we go through this, I just wanted to toss that idea out, friction and character. So now I want to talk about the sacred thirds in the development of soul, and this is just my 2 cents, well, 3 cents, since it's sacred thirds. In a lot of traditions, there are three dimensions to spiritual life. So, in Buddhism, a common chant or a trait is, I take refuge in the Buddha. I take refuge in the Dharma. I take refuge in the Sangha. So I take refuge in the Buddha means when I'm feeling confused, I go to the teacher of 2,600 years ago, and I take refuge there. If I'm trying to understand what principles I should live by, I go to the Dharma, and I take refuge there, because the Dharma, the collection of teachings and wisdom and everything, helps me find what I need. But I also go to the Sangha, and the Sangha is the community, and that's where we come back to that community thing. There are Buddhist monks who do go out and be by themselves, of course, but the great monasteries are sanghas. And the sense is that to really do this, sometimes maybe there's things you need to do on your own, but there are many things you need to learn in community, in the sangha, that you can't just learn with only the Buddha or the Dharma. There's some friction involved in living with other people. I'm just going to a little bit of a track here, but I heard Richard Rohr a couple of years ago in Santa Fe. He was talking about Thomas Merton, and as an aside, he said, you know, a lot of the monks at Gethsemane didn't really like Merton, because he said to them once, you're not contemplatives, you're just angry introverts. So, you know, even in a monastery where everybody's, you know, any of you that have got connected, or in religious community, it looks pretty wonderful from the outside. Friction moment here. But inside, there can be people that don't talk to each other for years. There can be people that resent somebody else because they don't do their share. So there's that friction that comes from being in the Sangha. I think in Judaism, there's the Torah, the great teaching of the first the five books of Moses. Rabbi Cohen talks about the Torah is perfect and never changes, but the interpretation of it is always changing. So there's this sense of this reverence for the five books that we're always going back to every week to find wisdom. We take refuge in the temple, the synagogue, the community of people that we're with, that we share things, and I'll be telling a story about that. And then it's such a strong thing in Judaism of tikkun olam, the healing of the earth. that I can be a great student of the Torah, I can be very active in my temple, but if in some way I'm not connecting with the healing of the earth, I'm living an incomplete Jewish life. And in the Christian tradition, one way it's been put is there's kerygma and koinonia and diakonia. So kerygma can be like the message, the teaching, which includes Jesus himself as well as what he taught and what the tradition teaches. Koinonia is community, being with other people. And from the very early stages, that's such a big emphasis. And then diakonia, which is service. That's where the word deacon comes from. And the Greek word diakonia basically meant like serving at a table, like being a waiter. Very basic kinds of things. But in the Gospels, we see this from the beginning, and in the tradition, at its best, it's always lifting up the kerygma, the really life, the incredible message and of who Jesus is and what he taught. Koinonia, what does it mean to be part of a community? And diakonia, so how are we going to serve? How are we going to do something? So in English, it could just be the message, community, and service or justice. Now for me, when I've been reading more, I see the personal religion becoming kind of where I find the Dharma, the Torah, the kerygma. But I just don't see a whole lot of beyond that, at least at this point as I've been reading it. I'm just a little restless. Going back to Walden, you know, his central metaphor is you go to a place and live by yourself. And then the fact that he brought his homeschooled daughter, which means that she's not part of public schools, which is everybody's right. But I always felt that any community we were living in, I got involved in the schools because if I want to be part of making the world a better place, that's where the kids are growing up. And how can I not be involved in that? Especially in communities that if we're private schooling, we pretty much isolate ourselves to the people we already like and associate with, and we're never around people of a different class or economic level or of a different way of understanding. We love to get away from that friction sometimes, and I confess, I developed my own personal religion, but I think there's this second third. The Walden thing is a great anchor. And it's not an either-or, it's a both-and. But one thing that made me think about was some years ago, I've been to Israel, I've been to India for Buddhist and Hindu shrines and everything, and I thought, the biggest saint and pilgrimage site in the Western Hemisphere is Our Lady of Guadalupe Shrine in Mexico City. Why am I not going? Why is that not on my list? So I went down to spend a week there, and I asked Father Virgil to give me some ideas on what to read and who to connect with. And I went down there, and I didn't know that it happened to be the day that Juan Diego was canonized, or whatever. So I walk, you know, I find my way there, and there's just tens of thousands of people, you know, the cliche is a sea of humanity, and all these groups from these villages, from all different parts of Mexico, with their own banners, sometimes their own instruments, their own people, just ecstatic as they were coming in to this great area of the cathedral. So that to me was when I think about community. I think in Mexican culture you have your own personal devotional life, you have your, you know, all the things that you learn, the rosary and all the prayers and everything else, but there's a real emphasis on community. So it's a contrast, doesn't have to be either or, but there's a kind of a both and going on here. And then, you know, to me, the biggest community experience in the world goes on at Mecca, you know, where every Muslim is part of the five pillars of Islam, is encouraged to go to Mecca if they can. And as a non-Muslim, I can't go there. I respect that. But I started thinking about that, and what came to mind then was a very powerful passage in the autobiography of Malcolm X. If you're from the 60s or 70s, that was a book that was around a lot. As you know, Malcolm X grew up a drug dealer, bad guy, pimp, got into Islam and was really into a very heavy anti-white track, a real angry, violent alternative to Martin Luther King Jr. But he went to Mecca as a Muslim, and it changed his life. And this is from a letter that he wrote from after being in Mecca. "Never have I witnessed such sincere hospitality and overwhelming spirit of true brotherhood as is practiced by people of all colors and races here in this ancient holy land, the home of Abraham, Muhammad, and all the other prophets of the Holy Scripture. For the past week, I have been utterly speechless and spellbound by the graciousness I see displayed all around me by people of all colors. There were tens of thousands of pilgrims from all over the world. They were of all colors, from blue-eyed blondes to black-skinned Africans. But we were all participating in the same ritual, displaying a spirit of unity and brotherhood that my experiences in America had led me to believe could never exist between the white and non-white. I am not a racist. In the past, I permitted myself to be used to make sweeping indictments of all white people, the entire white race, and these generalizations have caused injuries to some whites who perhaps did not deserve to be hurt. Because of the spiritual enlightenment which I was blessed to receive as the result of my recent pilgrimage to the holy city of Mecca, I no longer subscribe to sweeping indictments of any one race. I am now striving to live the life of a true Sunni Muslim. I must repeat that I am not a racist, nor do I subscribe to the tenets of racism. I can state in all sincerity that I wish nothing but freedom, justice, and equality, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness for all people." And he was studying the Quran. You know, and so he had the scripture to work with. He had his own smaller community of the prophet Elijah Muhammad. But I remember reading that, and he was just saying that no matter what anybody said in America, anytime he'd walk down the street, he felt different. And he felt on the edge. But in Mecca, everybody wears the same robes. And whether you're rich or poor or white or black or African or American or Asian, everybody is the same. I don't think he could ever have read that into his experience. It was this profound experience of community that really changed him and contributed to this development of what I would call his soul. So again, there is a both and. There's the personal part of us that in every faith, say in Islam, people do their prayers privately as well. But the question is, to me, community can be a very significant part of spiritual life. So what I'm going to ask you as the table time here to share this question with the people at your table. When have you experienced the power of being part of a spiritual community, and what did it teach you? So if you've been a part of a community now here in town or some other time in your past, when have you ever experienced the power of being part of a spiritual community, and what did it teach you? And I'll suggest then you engage each other at your table, and when each table is done, then people go to break. Does that sound good? Okay. You're released.